The political environment of 1896 had a lot of similarities to today. An electorate transformed by a growing immigrant population, an uncertain economy disrupted by new technology, growing income inequality, and political gridlock that prevented the parties from resolving big issues. In his new book, The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters, Karl Rove says many of the lessons from that presidential race can be applied to the politics of today. Karl, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
What caught your attention about William McKinley and led you to write a book about McKinley and his 1896 run for the White House?
Yeah. Well, I didn't start out to write about McKinley.
Really?
When I first sort of stumbled onto this in 1998, I was taking a class at UT, a seminar in historical source writing. And I wanted to understand how Theodore Roosevelt gets from 1895 to 1897, because 1896 is the lowest point of his political career. He's lost the race for mayor of New York, come in third. The boss of the New York Republican Party, Thomas Collier Platt, the easy boss, hates him, and he's on the outs. And the only way that he can rescue his career is to get a job in a new Republican administration in Washington. And he backs a friend of his, Thomas Brackett Reed, the Speaker of the House. Unfortunately, Reed loses the nomination to a guy that McKinley does, or to William McKinley, whom Roosevelt doesn't think much of. And so I started out to try and understand how did this year go for him, that he went from out of it to in it. Because without being the Assistant Secretary of Navy, his future as we know it, the future of our country, is simply impossible. Doesn't happen other than what goes on in this year.
So he has McKinley, a guy who's not all that fond of
him. Oh, no.
In fact, saving his political career.
You're right. Exactly. And the question is, how does he do it? Because at the day after McKinley gets nominated, he writes his sister a letter saying, quote, McKinley's a good man, but he is weak, and I worry about him in a moment of crisis for our country. And he has similar low opinion of that he's been sharing for months with Henry Cabot Lodge, his friend who's the campaign leader for Thomas Brackett Reed. So I got a professor who turned out to be one of the great experts on the Gilded Age, Lewis Gould, to take me on. And he said, okay, I'll take you on for this topic, but you have to read the McKinley papers, because history gets McKinley wrong and gets the election of 1896 wrong. And sure enough, the more that I studied the McKinley papers, which are a disorganized mass of documents at the Library of Congress and also at a sub-library depository at the University of Texas at Austin, the more I became convinced he's absolutely right. History gets McKinley wrong and the election wrong. It is a fantastic story with the most interesting characters, and at the center of it, the leading man is this very unique and special person called William McKinley.
So I was going to ask you about that. What makes this an intriguing story and not just a dry book about some dusty old political campaign that happened almost 120 years ago?
Well, first of all, is McKinley himself. We justly honor JFK for PT-109. We honor justly Bob Dole for, you know, for being gravely wounded in Italy. We honor 41 for enlisting in the Navy at the age of 18, becoming a pilot and being shot down in the Pacific. McKinley is an unbelievable war hero who received 3 battlefield commissions for unspeakable valor on the field. He goes on 2 suicide missions, one which he dreams up himself for himself as a commissary sergeant, and another one on which he is ordered by the commander of his brigade, who sends him on a mission that his tent mate said was a suicide mission. In fact, when he returns from it and walks into the command tent, his commander, Colonel Rutherford B. Hayes, himself a future president, says, "My God, I never expected to see you in this life again." And he's an unbelievable figure, and he is surrounded by a cast of characters that you think that some screenwriter hopped up on too much whiskey and coffee had dreamed up. I mean, they're one of them is from Cincinnati. Fire alarm Joe Foraker, who's the governor.
What a nickname.
Yeah, and he gets the name because he's a superior court judge here in Cincinnati who suffers a nervous breakdown and resigns. And a year or two later decides that he's going to run for governor, gets himself nominated for governor, is an incredible speaker, makes the rounds of the state, and picks up the nickname there. They think he is such an outstanding, such an orator that they call him Fire Alarm Joe. And he narrowly loses the governorship, but later comes back to be a 2-term governor and later a U.S. senator. But he is a rival of McKinley, who sees himself as president, who sees himself as the person that more people ought to be paying attention to than McKinley, and could have single-handedly derailed McKinley's nomination battle and nomination for the presidency had not McKinley been smart enough to say, I'm never going to have permanent enemies in politics. I'm going to try and make friends. And he keeps this guy close to him. In fact, he nominates McKinley at the convention, even after, in his third race for the governorship, Foraker has brutally slandered McKinley by claiming that his Democratic opponent for governor, Congressman Campbell, had signed a secret deal with a ballot box manufacturer to introduce a bill requiring a standardized ballot box for the nation, and that McKinley was part of the group that would share in the proceeds of this. And the documents turned out to be a complete hoax. But McKinley's presence on the documents, his name on the documents, and supposed signature, and the signature of Senator John Sherman had not kept the ambitious fire alarm Joe from making this outrageous accusation. And even after that, McKinley says, "I'm not going to let it get to me. This guy's important. He could really do damage to me if I don't keep him close. I'm going to keep him on my good side."
Was McKinley somebody who was driven by his principles, Carl?
Absolutely. He's a very principled guy. I mean, he grows up in an abolitionist family. It's one of the reasons why he enlists in the military at the age of 18. One of the first things that he does in politics in Ohio is work on behalf of a constitutional amendment guaranteeing black voting rights in 1865, right after the end of the war. It fails that November, and McKinley's decimated by it. But yeah, he believes, but it's interesting. He's an advocate of high tariffs, of the protective tariff, but not because he wants to enrich rich people. In fact, he wanted to moderate tariffs where it was possible and necessary, he thought, because his purpose was to create domestic competition and encourage the growth of domestic industries. And his question to people pleading for even higher tariffs was, I'm not asking how much money you need to make that you want to earn. I'm trying to ask how high this tariff needs to be in order to guarantee the growth of this industry.
What led him into politics?
Well, he came from a family where education was important, where he read lots of magazines, the Atlantic and Horace Greeley's New York Tribune, things that were anti-slavery in nature. He fought in the Civil War, and like many who came out of the Civil War, the war changed him dramatically. He felt he gives his first speech in what was then called New Berlin. It's now called North Canton, Ohio. Name was changed after World War I. And he says in that speech that we can't, in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War, we must entrust the leadership of the country to the Republicans, not to the traitors who had split the Union, namely the Democratic Party. So he saw initially his involvement in politics as a continuation of what he had done in the war in helping to save the Union by fighting for its existence.
Many of us look at politics today as being a pretty brutal thing. What was the political climate like back at that time?
It makes today look like we're all sitting around the campfire singing Kumbaya and roasting marshmallows together.
Really?
We have five presidential elections. Excuse me. We have five presidential elections in a row in which nobody gets 50% of the vote.
Wow.
We have two presidential elections.
In a row.
And two of them, a person is elected by having a majority in the Electoral College and a minority in the